beginning to wear on the market.
Weekdays at 10 on the Biz Radio Network.
You are listening to Bar Talk on the Biz Radio Network. This is Daphne Patterson and Nicole DeBord, and we are talking about criminal procedure. I forgot earlier to give you Nicole's phone number at her office in case you want to call for anything in this future time period when you have needs in this area. It's 713-526-6300. Now, back to our discussions. If you have any questions, comments, thoughts you want to lodge on criminal procedure, please call us 877-777-7713. Now, we've been talking about what happens when the client first sits down in an office with a criminal defense attorney, and we're going to move on from that now and assume that they've hired a criminal defense attorney and they're getting to that first day in court. And we're going to talk with you about that. So, Nicole, what happens that first day of court when they get there?
Well, this is really a great question because I oftentimes spend a fair amount of time talking with new clients about what exactly this topic. What can you expect when you go to court? Most people, their only contact with the criminal justice system has been either as a juror or when they get a traffic ticket. And so I think most people sort of assume that that's exactly how court works. You go to court, there's a trial, either the police officer shows up or they don't, and you go home. And the reality, as you know, Daphne, is that this is a much more lengthy thing. And usually the first court appearance on a regular criminal case, and I'm talking about a misdemeanor, not a traffic ticket, or a felony, is that the client, the defendant, the accused, is told by the court, really for the first official time, what they've been charged with. And it is really just a perfunctory thing. Most people by that court date know exactly what they've been charged with, but it's called an arraignment date. Often, so sometimes the judge will say, this is what you've been charged with. Now, in federal court, it's a much more formal procedure. The judge is going to read through the charges exactly and talk to the accused about whether or not they understand what they've been charged with. But oftentimes in state court, it's very informal. In fact, many, many times the accused never even gets up out of the bleachers or the benches in the back of the courtroom, and the lawyer is the one that is up talking to the prosecution and the court. To the court coordinator and so forth. So what does happen then? Well, you know, really what doesn't happen, which is trial, that's not going to happen on the first day. What does happen is that it's very important for the attorneys because it is the first time that the defense attorney is going to really find out what the government, what the state is accusing the person of in a formal sense. You're going to get to look at the indictment. Case is an indictment yet, isn't indicted yet, you'll still look at the charges, you can look at the complaint or the information. You'll oftentimes have at least part of the offense report and some statements in there, perhaps from witnesses. And this is your first chance as the defense attorney to lay eyes on these things. So what I do is I usually go and take copious notes so I can get the offense report number, I can get the time, the date, the location where the thing took place, and then I can start doing some research into the background on my own, which is really imperative. I mean, to be a defense attorney and to just assume that what's written there in that report is correct would be malpractice, in my opinion, quite frankly.
Now, you mentioned, I want to back up just a little bit, they're getting in court. Is there any issue about what time they need to be there, making sure they're in the right courtroom, or is this something they need to be particularly concerned about?
It's very important. A lot of times, you're either on bond and you're going to your first court setting, or you're in custody, which means, of course, you're in jail and they're going to bring you there on time.
Won't matter what time, will it?
Right. They're going to get you there if you're in custody.
Now, but your family might need to know, be there on time.
Sure. Your family would need to know where to go. What court to be at, where is that court, what time does the judge conduct business, those kinds of things. But more importantly, for those who are on bond, it is imperative that they arrive on time, appropriately dressed, which sounds very basic, but you'd be surprised. And oftentimes, defendants or accused people can be subjected to urine tests and things like that. So again, sounds like a pretty basic thing, but you need to be prepared for that when you go to court, if you have to go to court.
Now, what does that mean? You're talking about urine tests and bond. What does all that mean to the person who's not been in the criminal system before?
Well, if a person has been given bond or bail by a court, what has happened is that the judge has said, I'm going to allow you to pay a certain amount, say, you know, for a misdemeanor, maybe $1,000 into the county coffers. And as long as you show up and you appear in court every time on time and follow my rules while this case is pending, then you're going to get that money back. It's basically a guarantee that you're going to be there. That's what bond is meant to do. It's not a fine. It comes back to you, assuming you show up like you're supposed to and that you haven't had to hire a bondsman. Sometimes people hire a bondsman because the bond is, quite frankly, too much for them to just pay out of their bank account. And a bondsman will often pay the total amount or guarantee the total amount to the court. But what happens is that, let's just say you're on one of these bonds and you break your promise to the court. You don't show up on time, or you show up with perhaps some dirty urine. You know, they take your urine test and you forgive the slang here, but you pee dirty. You could very well end up right back in jail, and the judge could then choose whether or not to issue you another bond, and it would probably be more money, and the first bond could be lost altogether. So it's a big deal to be there on time and to follow the court's rules while you're on bond.
And those rules would include then, obviously, if we're talking about a urine test, not using any illegal substances, which may be commonly used in our city these days. And in are there not some more strenuous requirements sometimes in the DWIs? I mean, I've seen some of the judges not let folks drive if they had more than one DWI while they're on bond.
Exactly. And they could have a breath test device installed on their vehicle if it's a second time DWI.
What does that do, by the way? That's an interesting thing. That interlock device, what does that do?
What that's supposed to do, if it's working properly.
Supposed to do.
Exactly.
Are you unsure about this?
I have seen some failed operations on these. I can tell you that, unfortunately. I mean, in theory, these things should work well. And, you know, all of these conditions are probably well-intentioned. I mean, people are putting these conditions on bond to try to make sure that people remain safe and so forth, generally speaking. But what a lot of people fail to recognize when they set these conditions is that they're not fail-proof. And oftentimes people get false positives or show up, you know, that they're having alcohol in their system is simply not true. But the bottom line is that these intoxilizer devices or these deep lung breath devices that go on the vehicle are meant to require a person to breathe into the unit at many times while they're actually operating the vehicle, so that if the vehicle is being driven by a person who's got any alcohol in their system, according to what the book says it does, that the vehicle will not operate. And that's what these systems do. Or what they will do, what they will do is send a report back to the court indicating you've got alcohol on board.
And now you send the report back to the court. What's going to happen to the person when that report gets back to the court?
Their driving privileges are going to be suspended if they have alcohol in their system. And probably even worse than that, their freedom privileges are going to be suspended in the sense that their bond is going to be revoked and they're going to go back to jail. You know, one thing that surprised me, I can tell you as a very young prosecutor years ago, was that all of these people might be accused of a crime and actually just sort of have an appointment and show up in court. I mean, they can have an appointment to show up to court for a murder or a DWI, and that was surprising to me. But, you know, after doing this for some time, I realized, well, really all these people are just accused, and the jury hasn't sorted out whether or not they even did anything wrong. You know, and our Constitution, of course, provides that we all have the right to be heard and to find out whether or not these charges are, in fact, just. And so that's what court is designed for. We're not supposed to punish people for anything until we know that they're guilty of something.
I think probably one of the charges that many of our listeners will be more frequently faced with is DWI, since that seems to be a common issue out there. And so I think this might be important to them to realize some of the other complications that can get involved if they get arrested for this. And there's an expense with that interlock device, isn't there?
Absolutely. And I think this is a great time actually to give the number out again, so that people can call in with questions on this topic, which is 1-877-777-7713. That's 877-777-7713. And DWI is a hot topic because it's oftentimes the type of thing that we all know somebody who's either been caught for driving while intoxicated, been affected by someone who was driving while intoxicated, or who hasn't been caught, but they've done it. I mean, it's really not something that, you know, it happens to a lot of people. Let's just put it that way. And so you should know what the procedures are. I mean, if a police officer pulls you over for driving while intoxicated, you can expect that you're going to be removed from your vehicle, and that may even be on the freeway. You may be standing out on, you know, Interstate 45 with cars whizzing by at 70-plus miles an hour and asked to do a variety of exercises, for lack of a better word. You know, standing on one foot, walking a line, all kinds of other balanced exercises, like a yoga class on the side of the freeway. And it's not exactly very easy. It's a pretty nerve-wracking experience for
most
people.
Yoga's pretty hard on a general day. But
for me,
get out there and do it on the freeway. What, you know, not a good thing.
And you're already nervous because you've been pulled over by the police. And even if you're in just getting a traffic ticket, for most folks, that's a nerve-wracking experience. And they're recording you. So everything that you say to that police officer at that time, whether or not it's obvious to you or not, is being recorded. Your exercises are being recorded. And it's all going to end up on video. They're going to ask you to take a breath test, and then you're going to end up in court.
And maybe we should, when we come back after the next break, chat a little bit about your rights so that you know what you can and can't do at that point.
That's a great idea.
To sort of protect yourself and make your case a little easier on your defense attorney if you end up needing one, and possibly help your case not happen. You are listening to Bar Talk on the Biz Radio Network. Daphne Patterson and Nicole DeBord are your hosts today. Call us 877-777-7713. Talk to you again after the break.
You're tuned in to the Biz Radio Network. Every time the subject of information technology comes up in management meetings, I cringe. Look, I'm the boss, and I know.